Hello, everyone, and welcome back to SCADcast. Thank you for joining us. I'm Matt Nickley. We continue our sharing of interviews from SCAD to Fine Art 2020 with international theater artist, designer, and creative mountain, Robert Wilson. The SCAD community was treated to a rare insight into Wilson's signature theatrical styles through his performative lecture titled, 1. Have You Been Here Before? 2. No, This Is the First Time, at SCAD Show in Midtown Atlanta. His dramatic lecture was unlike anything seen on that stage before, and the audience was enthralled by the theater veteran's wisdom. Wilson's historic catalog of work includes original masterpieces like Deaf Man Glance and Einstein on the Beach, and the most inventive adaptations of Shakespeare, Mozart, and Puccini, amongst other classics. He cannot be encapsulated, and his productions offer endless sparks of wonder and interpretive possibilities. His command of expression and explorations across artistic mediums invite thousands to participate in the community and forum that live theater and installations nourish. We reached out to Wilson for a message to the SCAD community during the coronavirus. I'd like to read it for you now, but I strongly encourage you to view his original note on Paula Wallace's Instagram. Wilson wrote, quote, "Stay home, stay together. People's lives first. Stay home, stay together. Feeling of community. Stay home, together. Reassess the silence. Families, take care of each other. Stay together. Solidarity. Put people's lives first. Stay home, stay together. Take care of each other. What seemed impossible is now inevitable. Our world will be different. Together, apart, brings us closer. Stay home. Oddly being apart brings us closer." Unquote. In that spirit, let's get closer to Mr. Robert Wilson. From SCADcast, this is On Creativity, a conversation between Paula Wallace and Robert Wilson.
So wonderful to have you here, Bob, at SCAD for Define Art. We met up in Miami at Design Miami.
We did.
Not too long ago, and it's just amazing to have you here on campus. And of course, your installation there, A Boy from Texas. Would you like to talk a little bit about that installation?
Well, Christina asked me to do something. She said, I think it'd be great if you did something that refers to your roots in Texas. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in Waco, Texas, and my father would go hunting and each year. And for Christmas, I would get a shotgun or a red flannel shirt or cowboy boots. And
hunting paraphernalia.
And none of which I wanted. And I just wanted a gray shirt or a black shirt. And my mother said, you don't have any color in your life. She said, you need some color. So they'd give me a yellow shirt. But it was something I did not enjoy doing, was going hunting with my father and his friends. And what I learned to do is that I could go and wake up early in the morning and to go hide somewhere in the woods or the forest. And the other men were in blinds, you know, waiting to shoot a deer. But I could spend all day alone. And this was something I did enjoy. And I never wanted to shoot an animal. It was not in my nature. Nor did I want to pull the trigger of all the guns that I was given as a young boy. And I went back years later to Texas. They said there were 20-something rifles and guns that I had been given. This closet
had a collection.
All of these guns. But so the amazing thing is that I could sit there and occasionally would see a deer And we were very still, you know, and we just stand there. And Ezra Pound said, when he was in prison in Pisa, the fourth dimension is stillness and the power over wild beast. And it was amazing. You could be there with this animal, and he was still and I was still, and if I would move, he would leave, run away. And so this was something that has been with me throughout my life, and it's a part of my childhood, a part of my personality, and later had a, actually even an influence on my work as a theater director, the stillness and like an animal.
The concept of stillness.
That you can be there with the animal. And Kleist, the German writer, said, a good actor is like a bear. He will never strike first. He'll wait for you to move. That was always a part of my early works in the theater and is today, is to work with the stillness. And I think the root of it comes from being a boy growing up in Texas.
What a powerful influence. And you employed stillness today to great effect. This was such a spectacular performative lecture that you shared with our SCAD students today. And I couldn't help but notice that there was an empty chair strategically placed on stage.
Mm-hmm. Well, chairs have been part of my signature and the work I've done. I was about 12 years old, and I went at Thanksgiving, maybe I was a little younger, to my uncle, who lived in Alamogordo, New Mexico, in the white desert sands. And my uncle, Sherrod, he was a recluse. He lived all alone in this house that he'd made, and he painted it white. It was an adobe house in the white sands. And he lived like a monk or something. He had a Navajo blanket or on the floor. He had some Native American ceramic pots in a room, the only thing in the room. But in one room, he had a chair, a very beautiful proportioned chair, rather narrow and so tall. And I said to him, I said, Uncle Sherrod, that's a very beautiful chair. And at Christmas, he sent me the chair for a present, for Christmas present. So I didn't get a shotgun, but I got a chair. And this is something I loved. And I wanted to move all the furniture out of my bedroom and have only this chair and sleep on the floor like my Uncle Sherrod. And then I was 18 and I had gone away to the University of Texas. And his son, my cousin John, wrote a letter to me. He said, you know, my father gave you that chair and it's mine and I want it back. So I sent it to him. And ever since then, chairs have had an important place in my life. And usually in my plays, I have designed a special chair. And often no one ever sits in the chair. It's just Marcel Breuer, the Bauhaus architect, said, in the detail of this chair that I've designed are all my aesthetics. The same aesthetics that go into designing a building and the same aesthetics that go into designing a city are inherent in the detail of the chair I've designed. So the chair today is not something I designed. I just asked to put a chair. But,
a chair in a room, in a building, in a city.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
At SCAD, all of our students study art history as part of their core curriculum. And I know the art history has influenced your work in important mm-hmm. ways.
It has. And I always believe that it's very important. I have a cultural center, the Watermelt Center in Long Island that I established. And as a center for creative thinking, for the creation of new work, I think it's very important that we look back to where we from where we came. And we have about 8,000 pieces in our collection. And I went to an art school in New York, and there was no art. If I wanted to see tribal art, I had to go to a certain institution. If I wanted to see classical art, I had to go to another. If I wanted to see modern or contemporary art, I'd have to go still to another location. So my idea is that, anyway, with the Watermill Center as the cultural center for creative thinking, that we live with awareness of what man's done in the past. And if we don't live with this awareness, we lose our memory. Going forward, it's important also to look backwards.
Yes. Lighting and sound are also part of your work and very integral. And as you mentioned, part of your education was in architecture. How do you build opera with these elements of light and sound and line? You talked a bit about line today.
Well, I start with light. That's the most important. If you go to a restaurant tonight, the lighting probably was an afterthought. So I try to think about light first. Without light, there's no space. And light in every sense. So if you have to play Medea and you have to murder two children, how do you do that? If you're King Lear and you're playing Shakespeare's great tragedy, how do you do it? So you need light. And if you don't have the light, the darkness will not be as dark. So I have a white shirt and a black suit. And I can put my white shirt against the white shirt, and it's one thing. Mm-hmm. But as soon as I put this white against the black's blacker. Yes. And I can put the black on top of the black, and it's one thing. But the white is what makes the dark darker. So if you're Medea, you have to find a way of bringing light to the role. Every opposite needs its opposite.
The breadth of your work spans lectures and theater, exhibitions, and it touches on so many disciplines that we also teach here at SCAD: furniture design, sound design, performing arts, and film. Are you a conductor choosing your instruments?
I think I'm more, what I do best is structure and making a structure that allows for people to participate freely. And so if I am directing, I just directed Mozart's Messiah. So I have a very strict architectural structure. But once you're in that structure, you have a certain freedom. It's quite strict that my work is all, in a sense, choreographed. But once you learn the choreography, then you will find a freedom. The first time you ride a bicycle is a little awkward, maybe you fall over. But after a while, you can ride the bicycle without thinking about it. And you can think about something else. And so the more mechanical we become, the freer we are. And I've never been afraid to be mechanical. I always liked what Andy Warhol said, I want to be a machine. And I think what Andy was thinking about, you know, in being mechanical, you can be free. And I had a very... A dancer I liked very much, and she was a ballet dancer with Balanchine. And I asked her once, I said, when you do such and such in symphony and see the ballet of Balanchine, or what do you do, how do you do it, or something? She said, oh, I don't know. She said, yeah, but I know when I'm doing it. And so she's learned it, and it becomes mechanical, and then she has a freedom. Charlie Chaplin would have sometimes 250 or 350 different takes of a scene. So the first time you do something, if I have to do that again and I have to learn it, it takes a long time. Where did my hands start? Where did they go? Ba-da-da-da. So to break it down, to learn it, so it's free again. And that's what my work is like. It's the freedom comes from practice and from being mechanical, in a sense. The way a ballet dancer can dance a role and they don't have to think about it so much after a while because the steps become automatic. The mind is a muscle. So it's in that muscle of the body that we know what we know. It's the same with animals.
Fascinating. You teamed up with talent from different arenas such as Gaga, Allen Ginsberg, and Philip Glass. How do you communicate with a collaborator who may speak a different creative language?
Well, I've worked with Philip Glass, I've worked with Ginsberg or Gaga and other people, Tom Waits. If I'm working with Philip Glass, my work is one thing, but if I'm working with Tom Waits, it's another thing. So my work will change because of the person I'm collaborating with. And that's what's exciting about working, is that you can collaborate with other artists, so your own work then changes as well because of the collaboration.
From 12 hours to 7 days straight, your performances seem marathonic. How do you bring audiences with you during these long form content? Considering today's viewers' attention span seems to be getting shorter and shorter.
Well, those long pieces are, I did early in my career, I was interested in a theater that was always going on. Mm-hmm. And like you can go to a park, yes, and you can sit and you can watch birds, or you can watch people walking or running, and you can daydream. So the early works, if you're making a play that's 7 days long, you know no one's going to sit there for 7 days, night and day. They're going to come and go. And it would be something always going on. So it's like going to a park. Mm-hmm. And if you wanted to go on your lunch break, you want to go in the morning before you went to work, you could go. If you want to go in the evening with your friend or something, you could go. It would always be there and always happening. And so that was what I was thinking about with the pieces of long duration of time. It was to find time to think.
Yes, time.
So you could just go and sit there and watch something. And all of the early works were mostly silent. So it was like a fireplace in your room, or like a window in your room. You could look outside and it can be a storm, and then it's dark, and then it's light, and it's always there.
I like that idea. Mm-hmm. You speak about asking questions but not knowing the answers. How do you cultivate that comfort with ambiguity when working with students?
Well, it's a contradiction that I work a lot in Germany, and the German education, like higher education here, but especially in Germany, it's very much based on Greek philosophy, on the causal factor. So you do something because of a reason. And the Germans, for the most part, are incapable of doing something if they don't have a reason. I am superficial, Bugs Bunny from Texas. And I didn't want a reason to do what I'm doing. I just do it. But if I want, I can take time in the effect I make to find reasons and causes.
Yeah.
And if you start with a causal factor, you're going to make an effect. So in some ways, it doesn't really matter where you start, but I'd rather start with the effect and find the cause later.
You've been starring in and touring internationally in the Samuel Beckett one-man production. Why do you think Beckett still resonates with audiences today? And do you think your work will have that same timelessness?
I think Beckett was one of the great playwrights of the 20th century. And yes, I think he will resonate in the future. I don't know how far into the future. It's too soon to know. Yes, Philip Glass recently said, Mr. Glass, you think your work will still be around 50 years from now? I said, I don't know. I won't be here to know. But my work is different. I've never thought of my work as something that would be here in the future. Lincoln Kirsten said, Lincoln Kirsten was a founder of New York City Ballet and Balanchine. And he said in the late 50s, modern dance will have no tradition. That was a shock. But I look at what happened when I first came to New York, and the work we were doing at that time, it was never meant to happen again. You know, the seven-day play was an event, and the 24-hour play happened one time. So it was like a shooting star. So it's different than, say, Shakespeare or Tennessee Williams, who wrote a play that maybe will be around 50 years from now or longer. My work will disappear, but it was never meant to last. And it was a product of its time. And look at the 60s, what happened, the happenings by artists and art galleries. And we performed in the street, we performed in parking garages on rooftops, and they were happenings. We called them happenings.
Yes.
And so it was never meant that they were to be there in the future. And so if you're going to see the 24-hour play I did in the early 70s at the Opera Comique in Paris, you know you're going to an event that's never going to happen again. It's like a shooting star.
Non-replicable.
Exactly. So you experience something, and that makes it special.
Yes, it makes it special. Just like your performance and lecture today for the students, you know, they will never forget that. Never forget it. So we have mutual friends in Pierre Cardin and the late Azzedine Alaia. And I believe you saw some of their work.
I did,
at Scad Fash.
Yeah.
Thank you for visiting.
Oh, sure. And I think it's a amazing what's happening here on this campus or your campuses. One of the important things that happened to me when I was 17 years old, I left Waco, Texas, and this very conservative community, and very right-wing and cut off from really what was going on in the world, and went to the University of Texas. It was a student body of 40,000 people. You know, there were people from India, people from China, people from Latin America. I mean, it was so exciting suddenly to be in this people from different cultures.
Like a little United Nations of Art with students from
And that's what you see happening here, too. And that's really important for education, I think. That we don't get...
And you were making a plea for not closing people out.
No, it's very important. At the Watermelon Center I have a central doorway, but there's no door that's closed. It's an opening. And I said today, quoted from the Bible, that, behold, I set before thee an open door. And I think that's really important. It's important in our country, the U.S. today, with the current administration, that we get more and more cut off, that we keep the door open, that we know what is going on in Mexico, what is happening in Afghanistan, what is happening with the Eskimos, what is happening in China. Mm-hmm. And open doors is...
Yeah, you travel and work so much all over the world, you probably know more than most people do about...
Well, it's I'm right. I'm very fortunate that I don't know if I'm making a work like Mozart's Messiah. I can see influence from having worked in Japan. I can see influences from being in Brazil. I can see influences in my work from all these different cultures. I've been blessed.
It's magnificent. Thank you. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed hearing from Robert Wilson. You can learn more about Wilson's past and current productions, as well as view selections of his visual art at robertwilson.com. And remember, you can view upcoming On Creativity Lives as part of SCAD's Guest and Gusto program. Coming up next is interior designer and member of Queer Eye's Fab Five, Bobby Burke, on May 20th at 3 o'clock Eastern Time. You can learn more and register at scad.edu. I hope to see you there. Thank you for tuning in to SCADcast and On Creativity, executive produced by SCAD president and founder Paula Wallace, with original music by SCAD alumnus George Lovett. On behalf of the entire SCAD community, stay safe, stay healthy, and stay active. We'll see you next time.